This week on the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast, we look ahead to the summer with Dan Rona sharing thoughts on intentional professional development.
Rather than trying to study things that we like or things we know or enjoy, we need to focus specifically on the areas where we need to be better.
In an important area of focus for Fraternity Sorority Life professionals.
Where we need to be putting more time and emphasis is operating as a strategic manager of a large and complex community. And that means not spending as much time thinking about how to execute the perfect program and spending more time thinking about how that program integrates with other initiatives in the community.
Hello, and welcome to the Fraternity Sorority Life podcast. I'm your host, Matt Deeg, and this week, one of my favorite thinkers in Fraternity Sorority Life, Dan Rona, joins me as we talk about professional growth and development, one of our favorite shared topics. As we wrap up the year, we know that the pace of activity in Fraternity Sorority Life, the number of events and student drop-ins decreases, allowing us time to implement habits of professional development and take time to make ourselves better people and better professionals for the students that we serve. As Dan and I discuss, intentionality is one of the keys to professional development. He'll chat about how professionals can be intentional in determining what their focal points should be. But before that, I want to offer some thoughts about general intentionality in habit forming. In his book, The Power of Habit, Charles Duhigg explores what causes habits to be formed and continued, and he demonstrates this through what he calls the feedback loop. Briefly stated, this is a system whereby something prompts an action. The individual completes the action, and then they are rewarded for that action. For example, I know that when I get home from work, I read books or journals until a set time, and then after that time, I allow myself some veg time or TV time. So as you think about creating habits around professional development, think about how you will prompt that behavior. Perhaps a calendar notification like Dan suggests, or just knowing, hey, this is what happens when I get home or eat lunch. Then think about what you'll actually do, and finally, what that reward will be. As you create these habits, it will become much easier to carry them out once the fall semester starts and the busyness begins again. I hope that the following chat with Dan helps with your thinking and planning for professional development this summer and into the year. Before we get there, I do want to note that all of the resources or articles that we talk about on this podcast and any other podcast are available and linked on the podcast blog. That link is thefslpodcast.blogspot.com. And now, our guest for the day. Dan Rona serves as CEO and project leader for Rise Partnerships. Since co-founding the company in 2000, he's led training and consulting projects for more than 200 campuses. He specializes in strategy, systems theory, culture change, curriculum design, and interactive training. Every time he and I get together and chat, I always learn something and I'm challenged, and the conversation we had this past week is no different. Here's our phone call.
Hello.
Hey, Dan. It's Matt.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing lovely. How are you?
I am good. Just, yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for jumping on board with me, and I guess we'll kick it off on... You know, most people, especially if they're tuning in, probably agree that professionals should do professional development, right? We shouldn't just assume that what we knew or learned in grad school will carry us through the rest of our time as a professional. But I think the starting point is, how do I do it? How do I find the time, right? So, you know, we can talk all we want about what professionals should be doing, but I think the how piece is really the starting point for it. So, Help me understand that, or help our listeners really talk about how people can be more intentional about professional development.
Sure. So I think I'm a little bit biased in this area and have a different perspective than maybe some campus or headquarters professionals, because in the way that I engage with the fraternity and sorority community, I have to take the view that I learned a long time ago that I'm only as good as my last project. And in order to do high quality projects and to deliver value for people, I have to know the answers and I have to have that value created. So part of finding the time is also finding what your motivation is. For me, that's making sure that I'm able to create value for our clients and value for the fraternity sort of community. So that's sort of the attitude part of it. I think the other, in terms of strategy for how to go about professional development, I wrote a couple years ago about the concept of deliberate practice, which says rather than trying to study things that we like or things we know or enjoy, we need to focus specifically on the areas where we need to be better. So what are the things that you don't have or don't know or need to know in order to advance in the future, and then engage in those things. So finding the spaces where you need to do your own talent development. And then the other part of that is the deliberate piece. The deliberate practice piece, it's about uncovering those gaps in your expertise and your knowledge and skills. And then it's about taking it another level where you're intentionally trying to practice and incorporate it into your work on a day-to-day basis. So it's not just about reading a book. It's about reading a book and putting things into practice and incorporating them into your skill set. So you're intentionally, quote-unquote, working the muscles that aren't currently working for you. So the other element of sort of strategy about how to go about professional development. I'll talk about the how do I find the time piece in a second, but it's mostly about how you prioritize. And one of those one of the things that's helped me is to incorporate the four stages of competence model, where there are a lot of things that we don't even realize we don't know. And as you enter a profession or start studying a specific topic or area, you start to see all of the pieces that it starts to discover all of the pieces that you had no idea existed, or you might have known in your head, but then you finally discover that there are words for this, and then you start to basically unravel those unknowns so that you have a better sense of what things you need to learn, and then go through the process of learning it. So you move through this, and I'll share this as a diagram for the listeners who might want to look at it afterwards. You move from one quadrant to another, where you discover what things you don't know, realize what you need to study, understand those at a better level, all the way to the point where you know it so well that you can't remember what you don't know, or you can't remember what you learned. So it's about moving from basically unconscious incompetence to conscious competence. So yeah. I think I said that wrong.
Like unconscious lack of knowledge to like unconscious knowledge, right? Like you're just saying things.
Correct.
And you really do understand what's going on, but you don't actually have to think about it, right? It's just a force of habit that...
Exactly.
Except habit of knowledge.
Right.
Well, and I think, you know, when you talk about deliberate practice, I remember we had a conversation, I think it was at the gathering, and it might have been before then, that, you know, you identify areas or things that you don't know things about, and then you will devote like an entire year to reading and studying about them to really focus in your energy so you can become that expert in that area instead of just reading one or two books or bouncing around from article to article. And that's, you know, that's something I've taken into account this year as I've been like focusing in on, you know, specific month topics for journal article reading, right? So I know, hey, this is what I'm doing this month so I can become more knowledgeable, more of an expert in this area. And so I certainly, right, like that deliberate practice piece, I really can appreciate that and see how it is really relevant to us not just becoming very minimal knowledge, like knowledge folks in a field, but we actually have deliberate knowledge and it does become second nature to us.
Right. Yeah. A few years ago, I, actually about 10 years ago, I was, in the habit of reading 1 to 2 books, a month, actually in 1 year, one book a week. And there was no real strategy to it. It was just all of the ideas that I was interested in thinking about and learning about. And I that was helpful and valuable because it exposed me to a wide breadth of different ideas. But I didn't take the step of, it was harder to take the step of integrating those into my day-to-day work. And so instead I said, just like you did, I'm going to take the next 12 months and all of my reading is going to involve both journal articles and books and online courses and face-to-face events or programs is going to focus specifically on, in that case, first it was instructional design and training and development, and then it was hazing prevention, and then it was strategy and organization development, and was able to get much more deep into the insights and actually found time to then apply those things on a regular basis into the work, and that it made it much more, it made me a much better professional being able to dive deeply into those things rather than just being exposed to a bunch of different ideas.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, both you and I have approached this in deciding and finding, right, that first, like, quadrant of what do we not know enough about and what do we want to know more things about. And I think you had started touching on this. We're going to, right, like, so move me from, like, step one to, of, like, okay, I know I need to learn more about this thing, right, systems design or systems functioning or community development, whatever that piece is. So talk to me about then that intentionality piece of actually learning and focusing in on that area.
So usually it starts with a handful of books that have been recommended to me, and I have a list of, I think it's up to about 300 now that people have recommended at a given time. So it usually starts as the gateway. But beyond that, I'll usually be thinking about a specific project or initiative. You know, how am I going to want to use what I'm going to learn? And that will help narrow, you know, it's not about instructional design. It's about specifically face-to-face facilitation and learning new content as opposed to developmental strategies. So that'll help narrow it. I think in every case, I've found that looking for the quote-unquote out there in the real world, there are entire professions dedicated to many of the different topics that fraternity and sorority professionals address. And so we can learn a lot from the people who do that specific function on a day-to-day basis, whether it's marketing or curriculum design or counseling or organization strategy. And so looking for those professional associations, those, you know, for me specifically, about 10 years ago, joined the what's now the Association for Talent Development in the training and development field. And there were, you know, local chapters in the city that I was living in to meet with people, to collaborate, to go to events, to learn about what was happening in the corporate world and the nonprofit world. I think exposing yourself to those, how it looks elsewhere has been really helpful. So I think that's the next step of that process. And then, like I said, it's Google Scholar searches and scrolling through Amazon and to see, you know, readers who read this also read these other books. And then also skimming the citations. So, right. What are the five best sources that this person is drawing from that I also need to read if I want to have a deep understanding of the content. I don't know how to do this specifically, but it really helps to see different ideas. So I've read a couple of different topics on systems theory, and there are different perspectives and approaches on how it applies and how it shows up. And so it's really frustrating and helpful to read two different views on the same thing so that you're able to sort of understand the limits of some of the analogies or some of the concepts that people are using.
Right. I just encountered that too. Like this weekend I was reading or finishing up a book on organizational change theories. And the author went through how they've evolved and shifted from like 1960 to present. And so it was fascinating to see kind of the differences and how people have viewed organizational change through different lenses, from just the very basic like unfreeze change, refreeze model to a more postmodern approach. And, You know, I think being able to find a research paper or a book or something that goes into that broad detail to then help you say, oh, I should really focus in on this zone, can be really kind of cool. Well, you know, I know that from our conversations, you know, we are both kind of habit enthusiasts, right? And intentionality feeds that habit forming, and habits form and drive intentionality too. So let's chat some about creating habits around professional development, because I think we both have established our own like sets of habits around how we go about this. And my hope is that our listeners will begin to think about how they can create habits around professional development. So how have you created these habits, and how might some folks learn from that?
Sure. So I guess my habits are... they are technologically supported habits, I should say, because it's not so much a habit as trying to develop a routine, and that happens. I find that I do more work in professional development when I make it a part of my task list. So I have, you know, I manage my to-do list using Asana, and every day there's an alert that comes up that says you have to read 30 pages today. And so that has to be checked off by the end of the day. I am not 100% on that, but I am more than zero, because it shows up every day as to say, you know, you need to spend 30 minutes of your own time developing yourself. I think the other thing, this sort of goes into, I forget the source, but talking about, this might be Chip and Dan Heath, I'm forgetting the name of the book, Switch, you know, developing a habit of running every morning, you're going to help yourself if you prepare your outfit, your sneakers, get everything ready before you go to bed the night before. I think for me, professional development, I found it helpful to have whatever it is that I'm reading, studying, watching, listening to, readily available and on hand. So when I'm on a plane, when I'm on the bus, whenever I'm anywhere, there's always, you know, a book on Amazon, a journal article in my briefcase, or a podcast ready to download, like the last five that I'm trying to catch up on of yours. they're readily available, so I can't avoid. I always can do something in that downtime to make use of it. And similarly, I whenever I see interesting articles online, I'm saving that to a queue, and then able to pull that up in the moment, whenever it is. And there's I have a two article a day minimum. To be able to just at least skim what's out there and file it in my system. So I think the lesson from my perspective in habit forming is have things readily available, manage yourself so that you are doing a little bit every day. I think one of the challenges that we face is that our work is seasonal. And so the temptation is, like right now, after the exhausting month of April, we take a half a breath in May before starting to think about the coming year. And if we start and if we focus on developing our habits under these conditions in the summer, it's really easy to do that because you have slack in your you tend to have more slack in your time. And I think that can be challenging because as soon as August and September hits, you have the habit of doing it when you have free time, but you don't have the habit of doing it when you're busy.
Right.
So I think it's about figuring out how to carve out the 30 minutes a day or whatever time it is to do, you know, those one or two articles, those 30 pages, listen to that, you know, 30 minutes of a podcast. And so I think another part of it that I've had to look at it this way occasionally, like at about 8 o'clock at night after you've had dinner, after you're relaxing, especially on a day when you don't have an evening program or anything scheduled, you have to ask yourself how much do you value your professional development compared to 26 more minutes of Kimmy Schmidt or your favorite.
Right.
Your favorite show here that you know, I want to see this. I can watch this whenever I want, but I haven't done my 30 pages today. Which of these do I value more? And sometimes Kimmy Schmidt wins, and other times Peter Senge wins. But having to think about how you're spending your time in that way, sort of, you know, it's a personal guilt trip. I need right. to be doing my work for myself, and there's time for relaxation later.
Well, this whole thing about like scheduled professional development, which I do, certainly, right? Like I set aside 30 minutes a day and like probably around 4:30, 4 o'clock, 4:30. But I also, when I get home from 5 to 7 is my time to read and process and do whatever. I'm also fortunate that I have no other real commitments, right? I don't have to drive kids anywhere. I don't have to deal with like taking a dog, right? Like I have nothing. It's just me. But you know, I think the whole scheduled professional development, you can't ignore it. It's like when people schedule, I liken it a lot to working out, which is something I probably should do more frequently, but I'm too busy reading a book to do that. But I know you're like a cyclist, and if you were to skip, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 days of cycling, you would feel it later on. And so for those folks who are really into working out or exercising or whatever it is, they know that when you schedule that time and make it a constant practice, that it becomes easier to do. And I also love what you're saying about eliminating barriers, right? Because you could hit that point where you're like, I'm supposed to do professional development right now, all right? Like it's popped up in my schedule, I need to do it. But if you don't have a book set aside, if you don't have articles queued up, if you don't have something, it's easier to say, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do today. And so then you're going to skip it. And so eliminating those things by bookmarking, by, you know, always having a book or journal article handy, I really love that. And so taking that time at the beginning of the month or at the beginning of a certain time to like load up so you know, here's everything I need to do or am hopeful to learn about can be really super helpful.
Right. Well, and another element that just came to mind as you were talking about that, I'm looking here at my bookshelf and I have a variety of books from the, you know, 500 page heavy, I'm afraid to even crack the cover because it's going to be a 3-month project, to the, I'm probably going to read this in an afternoon when I get bored. So I think that helps too, is having, you know, knowing that there are some bigger pieces to bite off that you're going to need to learn, but there's also, you know, don't make it hard on yourself by only having that option to go to. You can, you know, have multiple books or multiple things open at the same time, and make sure you have the ones that are easier.
Right. And then I think, you know, with that, it's all about taking that information, then doing something with it, right? Like, and that's the other piece that we talked about earlier is, you know, don't just read for reading's sake. Read for, you know, something that's relevant or applicable or something. And I recognize this is probably a little bit more maybe disciplined or like you must do this and you can't have any fun, or that's what it sounds like to me even as I'm saying it. But if we're doing this and we're talking about becoming better professionals, right, like we should be intentional about what we're trying to do and focusing in on that. So one of the things I know we talked about in preparation for this conversation and this show is just the idea of professional competencies and the fact that, you know, a lot of times we feel like we should just dabble in a bunch of different things. And I know you sent me an article that I'll try to link on the blog about that. But can you touch a little bit more on professional competencies and what professionals should really be focusing in on?
Sure. So I think Jeff Kafad talked about this at the AFA annual meeting a couple of years ago, and it's a concept from Tim Brown, who's leading the professional design firm IDEO, and it's called the T-shaped professional, where the horizontal bar of the T represents having some base level knowledge across a variety of different disciplines or areas. And the ability to collaborate with others to work in those areas in the way that in my MBA training they told me you need to know all of the language of all of the people you're going to need to be working with, but you shouldn't know any of those things specifically. Your deep area of knowledge should be tying those pieces together. So then the vertical bar on the T represents that, having a deep knowledge of specific skills and knowledge and expertise in a single field or a single area. So in Fraternity and Sorority Life, there are a number of topic areas that we address, from academic achievement to student persistence and retention, to student activities and programming, event planning, to housing management, to budgeting, to assessment. But we can't be experts in all of those areas. We need to have a base level knowledge of all of those pieces. But then we each need to decide what the area is where you want to know more than anyone else in the field, right, and make yourself the expert in that area. And I'm going to make an important note. You can't be the expert by declaring it and talking about a couple of experiences or a couple of projects you've had. You might be able to find someone to give you a stage and talk about those experiences, but you really actually need about 5 to 10 years of serious study and deep practice to develop expertise to the point where someone should be calling you to get the answer because they are on the top of the T in that specific area, and you've done the work to really understand what it looks like in all of these in that one specific area. So, for example, you had mentioned hazing prevention a little bit earlier. I've been studying all of the literature and theories and approaches to hazing prevention for about the past 10 to 15 years. And I definitely, there are still journal articles that I don't know about, and still specific perspectives and topics on the issue that I'm discovering now. But I still probably know as much as, or more than, all but about 12 people, in our work, who work in this area. So there's really, you can have that depth, in one specific area, but there's no way that I can understand and pretend to comprehend everything there is to know about housing, for example. So I think another element of that professional competencies is not just knowing one specific area, but knowing how to find the people who have knowledge in the others. So you're not just you're not just going to read a book to develop your own knowledge. You can say, I'm going to call Dan Bureau, who's going to help me understand assessment, because that's not an area of expertise, and he's going to help me think about how I need to apply it in my work. And I'm going to call Allison Swick-Dutney at Plattsburgh if I have to deal with, if I'm working with a community where we have local organizations or where we have organizations that we want to remove who are on a state institution. So these are people who have dealt with these problems and studied and presented extensively on those areas. I don't need to have that topic knowledge. I just need to know who the people are who can help me. So it's not just about taking in new information. It's about developing your network of sort of having access to the answers, people who have the answers.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, some of that goes into, right, like, merging or thinking about those things that you yourself are naturally good at, right? So I know, for example, that if I design a workbook for somebody, it's going to look atrocious. Like, that is, I could read and study and do all of that and put a lot of time into designing a workbook, right? Or any kind of marketing material. But all of the hours I would put into that would get me only like 2 miles down the road, versus if I were to put a lot of time and energy and effort into understanding like systems dynamics or org development, which is really the things that fascinate me and that my brain works with, that might get me 5 or 6 or 7 miles down the road with the same amount of time. And so also being aware of, where you're putting your time and energy and effort to learn and to develop professionally. I'm not saying, right, and similar to what you're saying, you don't not get skills in those areas that you know you're not going to ever be good at, but recognizing those people and recognizing those areas where it's like, okay, I can pour my time into this, or I could spend time in this other area that I'm going to be more effective in. And so it's measuring that effectiveness as well as, you know, level of need.
Right. Well, and I'll probably talk about this in a little bit, but in that situation that you present, you could spend 20 hours making a document look good versus spending that 20 hours finding a partner who shares the same objectives for whatever that that project is, who might be willing to fund it every year from here on out to be able to have it produced and designed well, so that not only did you spend that 20 hours not doing that, not doing the design, it can actually look professional by having a professional do it, but you've also created a source of resources and support and revenue to be able to address that in the future. So you've solved that problem for every time you have to redesign that every year from now on.
Right. Yeah. And then you can put kind of your time into those areas that, you know, we've done a lot of conversation at the like systems level with you. And I think Jeremiah Shin talks about this a lot of like putting energy really where something is going to make a difference. So developing those partnerships and building those networks versus, you know, creating a pretty prezi that, you know, might be nice, but it doesn't help to move the community forward. And I think this is really a perfect time to plug and shift a little bit towards, you just had a new article in Perspectives that came out, and I finally got a chance to read it. And if folks who are listening haven't read it yet, you should read it. It's talking about the fraternity sorority professional of the future. And based off of some of the research that you all have been doing at Rise Partnerships for the first 90 days program and the redesign there. But can you talk about some of that, like the professional of the future and some of the things that informed your writing of that and perhaps how that might help guide individuals as they look at professional development?
Sure, absolutely. So when we started that project, we wanted to build it in line with a philosophy about what the professional should look like. And we needed, in order to do the design of it, we needed the core competencies, but we also needed something much more specific about individual knowledge, skills, attitudes that we need to cultivate through that program. And so we did document review, literature review, member survey, needs assessment, and a couple of other sort of data collection and analysis processes, and pulled all of that together to say to figure out where do professionals think their work should be dedicated, and we heard a few things come up over and over again. And so I think since I wrote the Essentials article on deliberate practice a few years ago, my perspectives have changed upon about what areas we need to be developing and working. And it's not so much specific topic areas or specific issues. It's more where we need to be putting more time and emphasis is operating as a strategic manager of a large and complex community. And that means not spending as much time thinking about how to execute the perfect program and spending more time thinking about how that program integrates with other initiatives in the community so that you develop some consistency across it. It's not as much about becoming, adding staff and services to your area to address or duplicate what's happening elsewhere on campus, but instead of spending your time building those programs, it's spending your time building networks with other professionals on campus or off campus even, who can help do the same work, who are topic experts in housing, topic experts in academic advising, et cetera, pick your area here. So rather than building that within our services, we need to be connecting with others across campus. And similarly, rather than spending our time helping students do fraternity and sorority life better because we're employees of the institution, we really should be spending our time thinking about how the services and whether the services that we have as part of our offices, and I'm talking specifically about campus-based professionals, map to institutional outcomes. And I would argue that a high number of services and initiatives that we spend our time on are not relevant or not directly connected to institutional objectives, and we need to maybe let go of a lot of those things. So I think in terms of professional development, where my views changed is, as I said, not thinking about learning specific topics, but developing skills and knowledge about organization level change rather than individual student level change. Like a lot of us are have been trained in counseling and individual student development, or trained in curriculum and training development, curriculum design and training and development, which is an individual level initiative. But those things only go so far. We need to be thinking about how we shape the environment in which people operate. And that's a different type of knowledge. That's organization development. That's community change. Those things are not based on, there's not as much power in individual level change in affecting those things. And so we need to learn that content and learn the ability to collaborate and network across many different departments on campus. And so I think those are the areas where we collectively as a profession would be well served to invest a lot of our professional development efforts.
Yeah, and I think that goes kind of not completely counter to, but it's just a different way of approaching our work, right? A lot of the folks who, you know, when you ask the average fraternity sorority professional why they got into the field, it's because of the one-on-one mentoring relationships that they had as an undergraduate student with their FSA pro, or, you know, that developmental experience. And so that's the model that we know. But we're being asked to do, right, we're asked to do more with less. And so how do we partner with folks? How do we identify those things? Essentially, and you and I were talking before we started recording about, you know, my focus on human resource management, right? How do we really manage the resources that we have both in the Fraternity Sorority Life office level as well as within our chapters and within our communities and even at the university level to be as effective as we possibly can, right? So, you know, why would I spend a lot of time learning how to do curriculum development and leadership development if I've got an absolutely incredible office of leadership and community engagement on campus who I can just partner with and work with, right? That's what they've studied. That's what they know how to do. And so really for us, it's learning how to draw out the best of those other partners that we have on campus. And, you know, that's all in that organizational development and community piece of recognizing and finding those needs, and then finding the individuals with whom we can collaborate to fill those needs instead of trying to learn and grasp all those different areas. I think that can allow for that greater focus and greater time to be spent on the community development piece and the assessment of community needs and all of that. So I like where you're going with that.
Right. Well, and I want to acknowledge that it's definitely going to be a challenge if we decide collectively that the research that we did is the way we should go, because people have come into our profession focused on working one-on-one with students, because that's what we want to do and that's what we think is important, and it will be a sea change to be thinking about systems level, community or campus level change as the focus. And I think, you know, but on the other hand, we've seen this in other areas. If you think about specifically about work in the area of high-risk alcohol prevention of high-risk alcohol use, where early on it was heavily focused on consequences and accountability, and then educational programs, and so people had to become programmers, and then over time it became about doing peer-to-peer educational programs. All along that area learned that its work should be different, needed to be different in order to be more effective. And then we went from peer-to-peer learning to more environmental management approaches, and so we're doing population level training using things like alcohol EDU, and we're doing town gown partnerships with local bars. There's not a lot of that going on, but there's a lot more to to environmental management in that area. And so the skills of professionals and the approach of professionals needed to change as that, as they learned more. And I think we're in the same spot. The interesting part is, I think, I don't know, I think that this is going to be true of student affairs professionals in general. So we're not the only ones in this boat, that we're learning that, number one, retention matters, graduation matters, student success matters. Those are the three major, and student learning outcomes matter. Those are the three or four major things that we need to focus all of our efforts around. There are things that we like doing and have done habitually and that we sort of started in the field to do, but those things will not be as relevant in the future in terms of achieving those outcomes, and that will be a hurdle for some people to make the transition.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what we're talking about, and you reference this in that article too, is the difference between like the micro things that we do, right? Like planning recruitment or putting together some kind of a training or whatever, versus the macro of community development and systems thinking. And I think if we boil all of this down, right, a good starting point or focal point for any professional would be on that macro level stuff, right? How do I understand what's going on around me, and what are those things that I can do to understand what's happening in the community, what's happening in the environment that I'm working in? And then as they go through that and are able to assess, like, here are the areas where I may not need to be the content expert, but I can just be like on the horizontal of the T, right? Like I can just understand a little bit about this. They can also see those areas where they really do need to do that deep dive because it doesn't exist on their campus. And so they can then find those areas that they're really going to seek out and develop deeper, like that more vertical side of the T-shaped model.
Right. Yeah, I think the thing that helps me get there often is thinking about how, about the student experience. So if you think about your interactions with individual students, it's probably with the leaders, especially the top leaders, depending upon the size of the community. But they represent a percentage, a fraction of what it means to have a positive student learning experience in their organizations. And so if you think about what's true for those other 20, those other 90, those other 300 members of the organization and what's their student learning experience, you cannot shape that as by working one person at a time or by working with one leader of the organization expecting that they're going to do that for the other 20, 30, 300. Maybe not 300, but except for on a couple campuses. But still, the premise holds that if you're focusing on one person at a time, you're not going to possibly be able to influence the student experience every year for everybody who comes through. We need to be thinking about bigger things, about how they engage with fraternity sorority life in their community, and how do we shape that on the whole, as opposed to through one person at a time efforts.
Yeah, no, totally makes sense. And I think that's something that we've been hearing and seeing a lot more from the association and from some of the, you know, different institutes that we have, right? So NOVAC for Hazing Prevention and the new Title IX Institute that AFA and ASCA are putting together, right? So more of that community focus. So with all of those thoughts, and I know that we kind of talked about, you know, focusing more on that systems and community side of things, but if a professional wanted to spend or take some summer to really focus in and do some professional development, and you were to be the doctor prescribing like specific focal areas for them, what might some of those be?
I think it would be assessment.
Okay.
And not just assessment to try to prove your work, but assessment in order to uncover the problems that you could solve in order to create value. So we usually focus on, did this have an impact? We need to start asking the question, where are the problems with the impact that it's having that would help us make it better? I think it is anything that is about group and organization level influences as opposed to individual experiences. And so that could be, you know, systems thinking. There's a concept called emergence. There are some concepts in group behavior that are different than, you know, and how group behavior tends to be different than individual level behavior. I would maybe start with, take a class in strategic management, budgeting. When we did the research, the macro level things that we saw more of a desire and a deficit in were about budgeting, supervision, pursuing new resources, resource allocation, those types of things.
Yeah. So really, I mean, kind of that management side of things, right? So learning how to manage a community, manage a department, manage the resources that we have, as well as find and almost like decide what new resources we need to get. So that's kind of making sense.
And I would add, excuse me. I would add a lot of those, at least what I'm learning about solutions in that area are that you can't be the person solving the problem. So anything you can learn about helping other people be the solution to their own problems. I can't list books off the top of my head, but there are a few where I've picked up insights on that you have to take the problem to the people who are experiencing the problems and help them work through the issue rather than being the source of all information.
Yeah. No, and that makes sense too, because it's also teaching them how to solve their problems, right? And preparing them to be critical thinkers, just like we're hoping to prepare ourselves to be critical thinkers in the fraternity sorority life profession. So
right. Imagine that if you didn't engage them in solving their own problems, they might learn how to solve problems.
Thus freeing you up to do like the larger systems things that you're hoping to do anyhow. So
right.
You know, I think the other danger in all of this, one danger in engaging in professional development is taking in a lot of information, but then it just sits there, right? And you have a lot of data and a lot of like knowledge, but you're actually not necessarily doing anything with it. And so what can professionals do, especially if they may not be able to operationalize something they're learning immediately, but in the future it could be helpful? How can they do more than just intake information with professional
sure.
development?
Yeah, I think I'm sort of kicking myself because a lot of the examples that we're using are about reading books, because that's the thing that
that's what
you
we
and
do.
I both enjoy a lot of, right? But I think that's sort of a skewed focus, because there are a lot of other ways to do that or things to do. I think it's building a network of professionals. So it's asking, who are the people who are the experts in this area? You know, I want to study this area. Who are the people who are the experts in this area? And spending, you know, a half an hour with 10 people, asking them 5 questions about the topic that you need to understand, and asking around to your friends and colleagues, who are the people who I need to talk to understand a little bit more about this. In this profession, there are many people who are willing to share their time and expertise in that way, and we've done that through some of our assessment and strategy projects, where we're asking peers peer institutions how they're handling specific types of problems, and we're learning a lot from that we couldn't have learned from a book or couldn't have learned from reading a best practices document.
Right.
I think, like I said, reading or studying content outside the field. I'm sitting here thinking that there's a difference. I sort of referred to this earlier. Reading a book is not as powerful as reading a book and reflecting on how it applies, and actually budgeting in the time and the work to apply lessons from the book into your work. And that's less than reading a book and incorporating it, something from it, into your next project. I think that's one of the things that's been helpful to me most, is There are half a dozen books that I go to regularly in the hundreds that I've read to pull quotes, to use concepts to figure out how to solve a specific problem for a client, to pull pieces into curriculum that we're designing. So it's about putting that to use in your next project in some small way. I think I've also recently become a fan of Coursera and some of the other online courses where you're actually sitting through a course, and that's because I am not enrolled nor employed by an institution, so I can't really take classes for free or enroll in them. So that's been a great resource to study, especially topics that are far afield from what we regularly do. So that's a little bit about taking in information, but it's at least in a different way. And I think I would go back to the deliberate practice. What are the, if you want to, I realized this morning as I was working on some curriculum for a client, I am really good at developing a learning experience in general, but not really good at writing the reflection questions. I'm good at doing that on the fly while facilitating, but not scripting the facilitator questions. So I've noticed that that's an area that I need to practice, and so the next piece of curriculum that I write, I'm going to put some time and study into figuring out how to script better discussion questions for facilitators' work. So it's recognizing where you need to build your skills and figuring out how you're going to practice it the next time around.
Yeah, and there's like a lot of intentionality and reflection just built into the day-to-day work as you're describing it, right? Like, you're going throughout writing this curriculum and you're recognizing, hey, this is an area I need to learn and grow in. And so you're making either a mental note or maybe a note in Asana or whatever you're using to focus in on that a little bit more. But then also, you know, what I'm hearing is we don't just read things, we figure out a way to incorporate it into practice. Or, you know, for me with the different, so this year I focused and decided I was going to read journal articles on specific topics each month. And, you know, at the end of it, I'm like, okay, I could just say that I read all these things, or I could figure out how to incorporate this into the work that I'm doing. And so, you know, either writing a blog article or a journal article or something based off of what I've just read to help, like, further explore or solidify my understanding of a topic, or thinking about other experiments or other ways that I could get at this information. And so putting it into practice rather than just taking it in. I think we've been talking about that, right? Like, deliberate practice doesn't just extend to the intake of information, but also to how do we incorporate it so that it's not just a book on a shelf that we've read or an article saved in a folder that we've read. So I certainly appreciate that. I think you also kind of mentioned this whole idea of discussing things with other folks, and you know, listeners of the podcast know that I've got the nerd group going on, and you know, we sit and we bounce ideas back and forth. But what about the idea of creating like professional development groups and discussing further concepts with them? I know you mentioned picking up the phone and just talking to content experts, but do you find that you do that, that you have like certain people that you'll call up and say, hey, let's chat about this idea or this topic? And what does that look like for you?
Sure. I've over the course of time, I've tried a few different times to create a group like that, but I've always found it challenging or temporary to manage that. We used to do a group called The Core, based on an analogy of our logo, the sun and rise, to think about new ideas and new projects, and that worked, but it was really high maintenance to do what we were trying to do with it. I've also spent some time just bringing together handfuls of colleagues whose ideas I admire and respect into like a reading group or a discussion group on a topic for a summer. That's been helpful. But at the same time, you know, again, hard to maintain on a consistent and regular basis. But both of those experiences have been valuable. I do have a handful of colleagues who I talk to regularly just to bounce ideas off of, and it's really great. I do that with Mike McCree regularly, who's a mentor of mine. it's really good to have someone who will call you on your foolishness, and at the same time encourage more of the right kind of foolishness. So it's really helpful to have a mentor or a coach, or at least someone who's willing to tell you where you're screwing up, tell you where you're getting it wrong, or to stretch you to think about things differently. That's certainly been helpful for me. In addition to that, I pretty much on a regular basis, just to, because I work on many campuses in brief moments of time, I don't really have the same type of perspective that those who work on a campus on a consistent basis do, or the view from the headquarters side of things, where they're working specifically with one organization and its mission and vision and goals and aims. And so I try to touch base with about 2 to 3 colleagues per month, just for a phone call that sounds much like the conversation we're having, just to learn about what's going on in campus, what their perspectives are, what their challenges are. And that's been really helpful for me, just to hear and see the world through their eyes and ears. Helps keep me keep my perspective focused on the things that are actually happening in the world versus my possibly different perspective on things.
Yeah, and that makes sense too, right? So talking with folks outside of whatever organization or entity you're working on, right? It can be really easy to get siloed into, this is what my fraternity headquarters does, or this is what we face here at Penn State, and ignoring the rest of the outside world. But, continuing to engage in those conversations. And also, I love the whole, calling somebody out on their foolishness or whatever, because you can, explore further concepts with them as you're doing that, right? So I might think that X approach to organizational development or maintenance is wise, but someone else could really challenge and push back on that. And that just makes you think further and think deeper about the concepts. And there's always good benefit in that.
Right. And actually, I want to take a brief tangent, because I think there's an important point here. It sounds odd to think of professional development being interviewing and other professionals who are in different places or positions and understanding their perspective. But I think that's where some of the most growth in our profession could come from, because there are a few colleagues, Jeremiah and Justin Kirk, who have shared some thoughts about this. But I think there are perceived rifts and differences between headquarters, campus professionals, trade association professionals, and even, I would say, associates or vendors in the profession, that we all see things very differently. And I think because, and we tend to blame individual people or organizations or campuses for the decisions that they made based on just the decision that they made. But if we took the time to understand the world that they're operating in, the perspectives that they have, the challenges that they're under, we would probably be able to do better work as professionals, because it is not the individual or the institution, it's the fact that we are operating from slightly different goals within the same community and slightly different structures of authority and types of authority in the same system. And we need to be able to understand the differences are structural and philosophical, not personality traits. And if we can figure that part of it out, then we can work on the fact that we see that we believe different things, or we have slightly different goals, so that we can figure out how to work on both of them together. So I think there's something to be said for professional development. An important part of professional development is understanding other people's perspectives who are working with the same students that we are.
Yeah, and that's, that's been one of the fun things about just this podcast project, is chatting with professionals on campuses, outside of campuses, who do, just like you, who are full-time consultants and developers for campuses and for national organizations. Just getting those different perspectives and understanding things. And it makes me think of some of those times when, on the NASPA Fraternity Sorority Facebook page, people will post a decision that some campus or headquarters make, and they'll be all up in arms about it, but they've never reached out to the individuals who are on the ground dealing with it to get the full story and to see, okay, what can I learn from you on the ground? And I've been guilty of this too, and I've tried to like temper myself and just now ask the questions of the professionals who are dealing with these things to, you know, really think about how might I handle this, or how could I learn to handle this differently based off of somebody else's experience. So I really appreciate that.
I wrote the beginning of a blog that I haven't finished at one point, that if you ever find yourself saying, what could they possibly be thinking, you need to actually go answer that figure out the answer to that question, because they were probably thinking something very rational and reasonable based on the situation that they're in.
Right.
And so if you can't answer that question, you need to come up with the answer to that question rather than just saying they have ridiculous ideas. You have to answer that question.
Right. Oh, yeah. So, you know, we're almost out of time here in terms of just the length of the podcast, but, you know, I can't let you go anywhere because we're both readers and nerds together without saying, or without asking, over the summer or over just time, what are some of the things like books, papers, websites? And I know we've been referencing these throughout the episode, but I'd love to just like get some very specific. Here are things that fraternity sorority life professionals should really consider looking at or getting.
Sure. Somewhere I have a document with the top 20 or so books for fraternity and sorority professionals that I would recommend. There are five that immediately come to mind. One is The Fifth Discipline by Peter Senge. Mm-hmm. Two is Organizational Traps by Chris Argyris, which I know you've read as well.
Yep.
The third, Hard Facts, Dangerous Half-Truths, and Total Nonsense by Puffer and Sutton, who criticize and critique in a very beautiful and brilliant way any leadership fable book you've ever read, which is the reason that I find it so awesome, and talks about what is actual science backup rather than what you know, Jack Welch and his end of one perspective on leadership say. So that's three. Four would be Leading Systems by Barry Oshry.
Oh, yeah.
Which looks at group-level behavior that is different than looking at individual-level behavior. And then five is an easy and simple one called The Decision Book, which a colleague of mine gave to me as a gift, and it's beautiful. There are, I think it's like 50 different models for thinking about how things work in the world. Beyond that, anything by Cass Sunstein, Daniel Kahneman, Alex Pentland, Chris Argyris, Peter Senge. I am every morning I read Seth Godin's blog because it shows up in my inbox. It's one of the only two things that show up in my inbox every day, that and Inside Higher Ed.
Right.
There's the most beautiful website I've ever seen is called The Art of Complex Problem Solving.
Ooh.
A guy who does visualization of he creates sort of visualizations of things for people. He's a diagrammer, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it. And he has there's a sort of interactive display of how complex problem solving works in organizations. So that's I just always go back to that for thinking through how to help clients. And then, as I mentioned before, a lot of the pick your favorite topic that you want to explore in Coursera. The best one that I've found the most helpful is called Model Thinking by Scott Page at the University of Michigan. He offers it on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah.
That talks about lots of different mathematical models to explain individual and group behavior. So it's a little bit of game theory, but it's not as it's relatively accessible for most people. But it really just shares different perspectives on how things work in the real world, and it's been incredibly helpful to me.
Awesome. Well, hey Dan, I really appreciate your time and your insights, and I think this is a good start of like professional development for the summer for folks listening to this and pondering things. And even as we chat, I'm like, I need to you know, we need to circle back and maybe have another one just focused specifically on like organizations and systems theory and just have another podcast conversation around those. So I'll be in touch about that.
Great.
So, but
well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate being a part of this. I love what you're doing and think it's long overdue and well needed, and happy to come back and share more.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Thanks, Matt.
So that's our show for today. I hope you're thinking ahead towards both your summer and long-term professional development. And as a way to prompt that, I'm offering a Fraternity Sorority Life podcast first. If you tweet at me, at Matt Deeg, with one thing you're hoping to learn about this summer, by the end of May, I'll pick a random person to win one of mine and probably Dan's favorite books. And, as always, if you've got questions, comments, or thoughts for future podcasts, tweet at me, or leave a comment on iTunes or on the blog. Until next time, stay curious.